Welcome to the Breakfast All Day podcast in all its various forms. Woo. We figured out how to talk into the mics. It only took us 4 months. It only took me. I'll speak for myself because these are my mics and that's his mic. It took us 4 months to figure out how to speak correctly because one of our lovely viewers slash listeners like scribbled down on a napkin, like a cocktail napkin. You're talking into the mic this way and it should be this way. So thank you very much. Yana, I believe is who it was.
Right. And, it turns out our mics fire on the side, not on the top.
You know what? I am not an audio technician, but anyway, we're figuring it out.
I've been doing a podcast for 8 years, you think I'd know better, but I don't.
Yes, I'm Christy.
I'm Matt Alonzo.
You're Matt Alonzo?
I'm Alonzo. Hi.
I'm Matt.
It's really good to see you guys. I'm happy to see you both. Thank you for coming back to my dining room table for our second episode of Breakfast All Day.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to thank everybody who subscribed already. We are now on iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play and a bunch of other places.
Podbean.
Podbean. So, yeah. So subscribe to the audio. Subscribe to the video here on YouTube if that's where you're watching us.
And you can't see her because she's lying down and you can't really hear her because she's not making any noise. But Sabrina is here.
Sabrina's here because we're talking about a doggy movie. So let's start with that doggy movie since we are here. It's called A Dog's Way Home, and it's not really a sequel to A Dog's Purpose, but it may as well be because it's essentially the exact same movie.
Yeah, this dog has no purpose.
to get home. Her purpose is to go home.
Yeah, I guess. I hadn't watched the trailer, so I didn't really know what I was getting into, and I didn't see A Dog's Purpose. I have a dog, and was joking with you and Nick beforehand, like, oh, who's playing the dog? Turns out somebody is playing the dog.
Boy, is she.
Right? Bryce Dallas Howard is the voice of the dog, Bella. I don't know where Edward is in this movie. Bella's a stray. We see early on that she's living with her mother, a full pit bull, which everyone is, or at least the animal control person, is very scared of, with a bunch of cats underneath a collapsed house. Animal control takes most of the animals away. Bella gets adopted.
But Bella gets suckled by the mama cat,
right?
I've never seen in the movie before.
And then she gets adopted by the nice young man who lives across the street with his mother, played by
Ashley Judd.
She ends up helping out at the VA.
She is a veteran.
Right. She's
PTSD, and then Bella winds up hanging out at the VA and being sort of a support animal.
Right. Bella ends up hanging out at the VA, but then, oh no, you can't have a pit bull in Denver, and so she gets taken to New Mexico and gets out. She busts out of the New Mexico dog jail.
It's a nice, comfortable home.
It's a nice, comfortable
house.
And they're
literally coming back to get her.
But it's not her home.
Nope.
And so she decides she's going to hoof it, or paw it, I guess I should say, back to her home in Denver. And sappiness and schmaltz ensues.
Oh, I wouldn't mind sappiness and schmaltz so much. I think genuine trauma ensues.
Yeah, there's like, some of that.
How did young Nicholas fare in this movie? Because I was astounded at what they were doing in a kid's movie.
You guys, he's so jaded.
He is jaded.
He's nine and he's like cynical and jaded. And so any kind of dog movie, he knows I'm going to cry. And so he just looks to me over and over again to see if I'm going to cry so he can then laugh at me for crying. So he was not affected by this in any way. But yeah, there are some harrowing moments, just like there are in A Dog's Purpose. What he noticed, his main contribution to our discussion of this, which I thought was a very astute point on his part, which I didn't realize in the watching of the thing, is structurally it's exactly the same as a dog's purpose.
Well, a dog's purpose, the dog keeps dying over and over again.
But the fact that the dog goes from one person to the next, to the next, to the next, and it's episodic in that way, and also the fact that there is wall-to-wall narration. So in A Dog's Purpose, it was Josh Gad saying adorable things. Here it's Bryce Dallas Howard saying adorable things. And there's so much hand-holding that goes on. Like, there is not a single thing that Bryce Dallas Howard says in the narration that we could not have inferred ourselves from watching the actual images on screen. There's so much hand-holding that goes on here. Like, it was cold. I didn't like the cold. Or, oh, I like cheese. Cheese was yummy and warm. Like, things that, you know, the dog is wagging its tail and eating cheese. That should be obvious that it's a good thing. So that was annoying. But what's weird about that is the narration clearly seems to be aimed at really little kids.
Oh, yeah,
but
this is a movie for 6-year-olds.
But then so much of what happens, as Alonzo points out, is really harrowing and stressful.
I cannot imagine taking a 6-year-old to see this movie and having them watch, like, a dog catcher, hunters who kill a cougar. Mm-hmm.
There's a brawl with a dog and a bunch of wolves.
An avalanche. Like,
I think
wolves.
Those are coyotes.
Are they coyotes?
They're
wolves.
Coyotes.
Whatever they are,
they're
wildlife creatures who are trying to tear sweet Bella apart. Like, it doesn't look great because there's a lot of uncanny valley stuff going on with the graphics, but it's stressful.
Bella, let us not forget, also at one point gets chained to a dead homeless man played by Edward James Olmos.
Down by the river.
Right. No van.
Be kidding me, movie. Like, you know, I was reminded of Thelma Ritter and All About Eve. What a story. Everything with the bloodhounds yapping at your rear end, you know. Like, so much stuff happens in this movie, and I think is like that most kids would find just beyond the pale.
Right. And yet it is PG.
Unless they are jaded Nicholas Lemire.
Totally. And yet it is rated PG, and the cutesy VO is meant for kids.
Yeah.
It's a weird sort of cross section of stuff here.
You know,
I should have been crying the whole way through this, right? You and I, Alonzo, both, we acknowledged before we even began this, that, like, we are soft touches when it comes to anything with a dog. Like, that Lassie remake that came out in 2006 or whatever it
was. That's the one to go see.
Sobbing.
You want to see a movie about a dog going home, go see that 2005 Lassie. It's amazing.
And nobody has to, like, do the Lassie voice saying, I was cold. So clearly the dog is cold. I was not upset at all until, like, spoiler. Okay, the dog gets home. Okay,
this
is not a spoiler.
Right.
You don't call a movie A Dog's Way Home and then, like, not have the dog go home. The dog goes home, and that is when I'm like, shit, forget it.
I know. Yeah, I think, like, I literally said, God damn it, out loud, and just started crying.
Yeah, I mean, this movie, I did come out, I was like, I can't wait to get home and cuddle with my dog. Right, and brought her today, which I did. The other thing this movie, for a dog, first of all, the dog is, everybody thinks is a pit bull. That dog doesn't really look anything like a pit bull.
Nope.
Like, there's kind of, I have a hard time believing that dog came from that mother dog. But
the movie does have a pro.
Well, so it does, you know,
adoption.
It does say not just pro adoption, like the
pro pit bull,
right? The woman at, like, kind of the central repository, like the central shelters, like, yeah, pit bull, you know, like the idea of labeling dogs pit bulls, it's like calling a dog a hound. Like, it's broad. It doesn't mean all that much.
It's fear mongering.
Mm-hmm. So.
This is directed by Charles Martin Smith, who starred in Never Cry Wolf, which is also a much better movie about dogs.
He must have hated the wolves in that, because he makes the wolves. See,
yeah, the wolves are really bad
I'm
guys.
I'm fairly convinced those are coyotes.
Do coyotes live in the snow?
I think they're wolves.
I think they're coyotes.
Because
wolves are much bigger than that.
Well, the CG is very iffy, especially when it comes to that cougar.
No, like, wolves would be almost the size of that cougar.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, but he also directed...
We're talking about the cat. We're not
Air Bud
talking about.
And Dolphin Tale.
This is his wheelhouse.
So, yeah, this is clearly his jam. But, yeah, I just... The tonally, this is like, who is this movie for? Because you're right, the narration is, like, over-cute by half, and even by, like, dog narration standards. And then, like, really dark, dark shit happens, you know. I will give this movie points for... including a gay couple and making not a big deal about it. Like, at one point, this guy is snowshoeing and there's an avalanche and his dog and Bella both dig him out. And when he gets taken
having caused the avalanche, so they'd better dig him out.
Right. The barking causes the avalanche. So it must have been like a hair trigger. Anyway, so that guy gets taken off to the hospital, and this couple who's cross-country skiing take in both of the dogs, assuming that both of the dogs belong to the snowshoe guy. And it's obvious that they're a gay couple. They never come out and say so, but, like, there's pictures of them together on the mantle, and they live together, and, you know, and I just thought, wow, okay, We have reached a point where in a PG movie aimed at children, you can have this couple in there and it's no big deal, because the canard that, about queer inclusion is always like, I don't want to have to explain to my kids about butt sex. And it's like, you don't have to. That's right. Not what this is about.
Right. In a movie that also makes a point of being like really, you know, pro vet and like, you know, right. And so I couldn't help but thinking as this movie's going by, I'm like, this is a movie, like, is this made for, you know, middle America, red states? I mean, not to get too political with it, but I'm like, this is, lot of cases, this is a super safe movie for a certain audience.
I just watched 38 Hallmark Christmas movies, so my radar is very attuned to, like, what messages we're sending to mid-America. But, yeah, like, the veteran stuff, I thought was very nicely done. It was never heavy-handed or, like, you know, our troops, if anything, it's like, our troops are suffering now, and the VA needs more support than, you know, like, we need to you know, do stuff for them. So, like, that was smarter and cooler than it could have been.
And the moment where they all stand up for the dog is quite lovely.
It
and,
is.
You know, when they all say, you know, there's a moment where having been veterans is germane to their fight for the dog.
Right. The other
that part's nice.
And the central relationship is an interracial couple, is the other thing.
Right. The other thing I liked about, one of the things that I'll give this movie a point for is casting Wes Studi and not making him have to be, like, only a Native American character.
Right.
Like, you know, so I'd like to see him have more screen time. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of his, but it's nice to see him just be a guy.
And also with the Edward James Olmos character, there's a lot of sympathy for him and the fact that the dog at that point in his life is his only friend, and there's some kindness there. So yeah, it does have a lot of inclusivity in a way that doesn't feel mawkish or forced or heavy handed. It's quite generic and organic, rather.
Still not very good.
The movie itself is not very good. Yeah, it's funny. Chris came and met us at the mall after the movie, and he's like, how was it? And I said, it's terrible, but it's effective. And then I went back and I watched our What the Flick review of A Dog's Purpose, and I said the exact same thing 2 years ago. This month, 2 years ago, A Dog's Purpose came out, and I said, it's terrible, but it's effective. It does what it sets out to do. So,
if you like The Dog's Purpose, then this is probably going to press your buttons.
They're very similar. Okay, so what are your numbers then? I'm saying 4.
I said 5.5. I think there's a lot of competence to it, and it did make me feel things, even when I was sort of aghast at, like, where it was going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what did I say? 4.5?
You said 4.5.
4.5. This is a bad dog movie. It's not a movie about a bad dog.
Bella's
a good dog.
Dog movie.
Bella's a good dog. So our number's a 4.7. It's at 56% on the tomato meter.
Right.
Go watch any Lassie instead.
Yes, but definitely the 2005 one.
But pet your dog.
Yes. Adopt. You know, spay and neuter your pets. All that stuff.
Now we're going to talk about the other big release of the week, which is The Upside.
I'm Alonzo. I haven't seen it.
Oh, hi. I'm Christy.
I'm Matt. I saw it.
Alonzo.
The Upside is I didn't see The Untouchables.
Alonzo is your bet. Oh, did you not? Did you see The Untouchables, Alonzo?
No, I never wanted to. It just seemed so icky, ooky, gross. I didn't.
I've seen everything. So I am happy to describe, and I had to review this movie for RogerEbert.com. And boy, is it January. Ooh, boy. So the thing with The Untouchables, which was the French film this is based on, is it was a huge, huge hit when it came out in 2011, I want to say. Like, it broke all kinds of box office records. It's enormously crowd-pleasing. Omar Sy, who is in the Kevin Hart role in this, is he beat, what's his face? Jean Dujardin. What was his name?
Oh,
from The Artist?
From The Artist? Yeah, Jean Dujardin.
He beat him that year for the Caesar for Best Actor. So it was a huge hit in France. And as I was watching it, it was immediately clear, like, they're going to remake this. This is such an easy, crowd-pleasing formula that someone somewhere is going to take this movie and do an English-language remake of it and put Hollywood stars in it and try to cash back in on that feel-good tale all over again.
And that someone was Harvey Weinstein.
And that's why this movie is coming out a year and a half after it played at Toronto. So you didn't see it at Toronto?
No, I never.
Okay.
Interesting.
Never saw it.
Yes. So that's why it's coming out now. But the timing of it is also a little unfortunate for Kevin Hart.
Mark Harris had a great tweet today. He goes, it's just that Kevin Hart is Gotta Be Me tour to support a film that spent a year and a half stuck in Harvey Weinstein's zipper.
Yeah.
Ooh.
But this would be bad any time of year. So it is based on this true story of a wealthy multimillionaire quadriplegic who is white and seeks 24-hour care for all of his needs and hires a black ex-con who is totally not qualified for it and stumbles into the job interview, but he gets the job because he's the only person who does not condescend to this man. He's the only person who, like, has an edge to him and an attitude to him, and the guy likes that.
Well, but I think also the character that Cranston is playing doesn't want someone all that qualified. Right.
Right. Like, that's the difference in this one. That's different here. So, yeah. So Bryan Cranston is the wealthy white guy. Kevin Hart is the fast-talking ex-con, streetwise ex-con. And it is pretty much exactly what you think that kind of movie is going to be. You know, they have socioeconomic and racial clashes and fish out of water situations, and the black dude helps the white dude loosen up, and the white dude helps the black dude appreciate things like opera.
No.
And modern art.
Really?
Yep. That's why.
God,
yep. That's why.
Such a cliche.
Ness and Dorma is a key plot point, and that's why that is the song of our episode this week on Breakfast All Day.
God, that is the thing I hate so much in movies. Where, like, I'm fancy now because someone taught me about opera.
Right. And at least, you know, say what you will about Green Book, at least Green Book, like, reversed those racial roles in that cliched situation, you know? We're going to talk about Green Book later on too. So, these are people who are pros, right? I mean, and they're giving it their all, but there is nothing to these characters. And this film is more than 2 hours long.
Well,
it's like 126 minutes. And both of these guys, both of these guys are on screen for the entirety of the film. And they really never feel like anything more than just very facile types. Right, that Kevin Hart is the ex-con, and he's streetwise, and he's raunchy, and he's irreverent. And then the Bryan Cranston character, he is in a wheelchair because he suffered this horrific hang gliding accident. And he has this incredible art collection, and he is a widower, and he likes all the finer things in life. And so each of them is that person for the entirety of the film, although supposedly by the end, each of them has transformed the other.
So it's basically Different Strokes for adults.
It is. It's Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah.
But he's in a wheelchair.
Yeah. I didn't hate this movie. No. There were moments that it kind of worked for me. But again, like, I hadn't seen the original one. There are, you know, I actually thought you had something more nuanced from Kevin Hart. Like, this is him not doing crazy over the top, like, spastic.
It's
Kevin
not fast talking
right?
shtick.
No, it's you know, this is a guy who's got, you know, he's out of prison. He's got, like, it was a more serious, kind of grounded performance out of him than I think that I've seen in a while. And I actually was kind of impressed. I was like, oh, yeah, I'd watch more of him doing, like, somewhat more serious roles.
I'm not sure he has it in him yet.
I don't know.
I think
he's
inching toward it.
Right. You know, but it's interesting because, you know, he's got enough charisma that, like, he's got this kind of easy charm that he does. You know, he's not, you know, again, like, he's not that frenetic kind of fast talking thing. It's more just like he's flirty and he's, you know, sarcastic and
inappropriate,
yeah. But not like that didn't feel all that forced to me. I actually enjoyed watching him more than I think I enjoyed watching Cranston in this. Although I think Bryan Cranston was relatively good in this too. I didn't hate, I mean, look, like, this is something that in 2 years I'll forget that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's one of those things that, like, if it's on, it's like, well, okay. I guess part of it is I went into this with super low expectations, which makes a big difference. It is too long.
Mm-hmm.
And it also is, as I thought about this towards the end, it's dangerously close to doing the Magic Negro trope.
Yep.
Right?
It is. No, it totally is that. And that was a problem with the original, too. The original was charming despite that uncomfortable trope.
Right. Even though it's hard to say that because, I mean, like, how much can we say that if that's something that actually happened?
It is supposedly something right. that actually happened.
But there is something always that's iffy about, like, you know, the black guy teaches the white guy, like, how to live freely and robustly, and the white guy teaches the black guy, like, you know, culture and responsibility.
Right.
Like, that's
like he's civilizing
yeah,
him.
Yeah, that's very. So
it's icky.
Yeah.
The thing with the original film is that there was sort of a subversive nature to the humor, and that seemed refreshing, and it wasn't as mawkish and condescending as it would sound on paper. The problem is, so Neil Berger directed this, who also did Limitless and Divergent. He takes, yeah, he takes entire like scenes and images and jokes and just repeats them from the original film without really breathing a whole lot of new life into them. And so there's a Hitler joke in here that seemed kind of like subversive and kind of daring in the original and just totally falls flat here. Do you remember the Hitler joke,
yeah,
Matt?
Oh, yeah. I remember.
Right. So it's not that funny. Like, I think the whole room is supposed to be laughing. Like, oh, my God, they went there.
Well, and you see it coming, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you see everything in this movie happening a mile away.
Let's talk about Nicole Kidman.
I was about to ask, how's Nicole Kidman?
Good Lord. Is she given the most thankless role? She's given nothing to do beyond playing this one note of being the disapproving, uptight executive assistant who works for Bryan Cranston, who does not want him to hire Kevin Hart. And is constantly looking for him to screw up so she can fire him.
So Sean Hayes on the bucket list.
I will say I kind of kept expecting her to, you get this tight shot of her taking her glasses off and shaking her hair and suddenly being transformed into this vision because she's so uptight in this movie. And like you almost kind of expected that.
Does
she finally melt when she laughs at something that Kevin Hart says or does?
I think she laughs a little bit at something once. I don't know.
No, he gets her dancing.
Yeah, but even that, she's like stiff and awkward doing. I don't know why Nicole Kidman said yes to this. Similarly, Julianna Margulies has like one scene and doesn't get a whole lot to do beyond the one note of that character in that one scene. And then, pretty much that's true of all the women here. It's all about the Kevin Hart and Bryan Cranston show. And they don't even have that much chemistry with each other. It's weird.
Yeah, it's not a catastrophe. It's watchable. I didn't hate it.
No, it's not a catastrophe.
It's not a catastrophe.
It's workmanlike.
I've seen worse.
Like, we've seen worse in January. Yeah, that's true.
It's thoroughly mediocre.
So
you made me realize I've my score is too high.
Okay, so where do you want to change it to?
I'm going
to
change it down to like a 5. It's fine. It's fine.
Okay.
It's so fine.
4.3. Okay, so I'm saying...
No, I said fun.
So Matt's saying 5. I'm saying 3.5. So that is a 4.3 for us. It's a 40% on the tomato meter. And we're going to talk about Kevin Hart a little bit later on, too, because the timing of all this is really unfortunate for Kevin Hart, because he's got to go do this media tour for this movie. It's the biggest movie of the week opening here. He's got to go on places like Good Morning America and talk about the movie, ostensibly, but also he's getting questions about the Oscars. So we'll talk about that later on, too. We're playing a little bit of catch up at this point, Christy and Alonzo and Matt.
Hi.
And we had to find out what was the deal with this Bird Box phenomenon.
What's in the Bird Box?
What's in the box? And
it's not a bucket of chicken.
People taking the Bird Box, it's not Gwyneth Paltrow's head. And people taking the Bird Box challenge.
Well, she's not a bird.
To extremes. Like hockey players at the rink where Nick plays hockey, like the Ontario Reign guys, were doing like drills, like passing drills
with blindfold on.
Oh. Hey, listen, I drove to work. I drove here today blindfolded.
Apparently,
Sabrina told me where to go.
Apparently, the house in Monrovia, where a lot of the film takes place, is like it's become like a tourist destination. People are like doing stuff with blindfolds there. Anyway,
nice.
Alonzo, please catch us up on this Netflix sensation, Bird Box.
Okay, so while this sounds a lot like the premise to A Quiet Place, it's actually based on a novel that came out first. There is a sudden rash of unexplained suicides taking place in Russia and other places. Meanwhile, abstract artist Sandra Bullock is pregnant, and her sister, Sarah Paulson, takes her to an OB appointment. And on their way out of the hospital, whatever it is that's making people kill themselves elsewhere is doing it in the States. And Sandra Bullock manages to hide in a house with some other survivors, sort of Night of the Living Dead style, and they kind of figure out that if you look at the aliens, they make
you wanna, whatever they are.
Or whatever they are. They make you want to kill yourself. And so,
unless you are criminally insane. Unless you are already psychotic, insane. In which case it kind of cures you.
Yeah.
Or not cures you. You're on that team.
Exactly.
Is that the case?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
All right.
And this is all intercut with 5 years after the beginning of the incident where Bullock and a boy and girl who she calls boy and girl are traveling downriver in the hopes of finding sanctuary.
Did she read too much Cormac McCarthy?
Exactly. Through flashbacks, we find out how they got there and where they're going and what it's all about. And I didn't hate this.
I kind of like this.
It's too long, and it's directed by Suzanne Beer, who I generally don't care for as a filmmaker.
So she did, like, Things We Lost in the Fire.
Yeah,
she does some very dour, very self-serious
I'm usually
films.
Not into her stuff. But I thought this was interesting because, it's funny, there's a joke at one point, Lil Rel Howery plays a guy who works at a grocery store who's writing an apocalyptic novel, and he says, it's not about kids with crossbows, it's the real thing. And I sort of enjoyed seeing a post-apocalyptic film that was not a YA film. That was sort of a refreshing difference that, oh, look, adults are dealing with this stuff. And, you know, I think Sandra Bullock's really good. The movie does have a real tension to it. I had some, you know, like covering up my eyes moments. It could be shorter, but beyond that, I think it's mostly effective.
This movie's so stupid, you guys. This is like this is like one of those like 70s all-star disaster movies. This is an art house version of Airport. That's
it's
all this is. No, it
or
is.
Earthquake.
It is. It's like, oh, look, there's Jackie Weaver. Oh, look, there's John Malkovich. Oh, look, there's Gervonta Rhodes. Oh, look, there's Rosa Salazar. Oh, look, there's Machine Gun Kelly. He makes it edgy. This movie is so stupid, you guys. Everyone does the most stupid shit in this movie. And I don't even understand. I'm not sure it is quite so cut and dried that if you're already crazy, you can see whatever this thing is. And
No, it is. No, it's the first person that we see doing that is the guy that Lil Rel Howery says he went to jail and he's a little crazy, but he's always been nice to me.
Right.
And so my question for the whole movie was like, what about blind people? And that gets answered very late in the film.
Yes.
But yeah, no, I think it is made
Do
pretty
you think
clear
so?
That crazy people
okay.
yeah, are on team monstrous
okay
threat.
So what is the thing? Sometimes you can see it, sometimes it's just like the wind, sometimes mm-hmm. it's just like a big swirl of leaves. What is the thing, do you think? I mean, I'm all for ambiguity, but this was like frustratingly
so
empty.
Has all those drawings. I assumed it was something along those
lines. I kind of dug this movie. I was really intrigued, and I went into this one with particularly low expectations because you had said how stupid you thought it was, and
yeah,
I don't agree.
And I was right.
I kind of enjoyed this. I found that there were interesting things going on with the characters. You never actually get to see what these entities are. You don't know what they are. You don't know where they're from. You don't know if it's supernatural. You don't know if it's alien. You don't know. You really don't
viral?
Know anything.
Yeah. And you don't know what it is that the people see or think about or whatever that makes them kill themselves.
What you get hints of with the sound design and the effects is that it's unique to each person.
Yes.
And so what I think, there's drawings that come up, and I don't want to spoil what they are. It's that the drawings are all different from the guy who's seen the monsters and, or whatever it is, and says it's beautiful, who is clearly insane. My interpretation is that it is unique to each person. It's whatever that horror is, whatever that fear or sadness or whatever that is so devastating, it makes them kill themselves.
It knows what scares you.
Well,
like Poltergeist. Right.
Or it knows what's going to get to you in the end. Right. And I thought that worked because it first of all, like, it gets you off the hook of having to create something that is that scary.
Sure.
It almost is like, it's the thing that I always thought that Lovecraft would cheat about when he would write about, like, and then they looked upon the face of Cthulhu and words cannot describe, but it drove them all insane. And to relate what they saw would be to describe the face of madness. Like, okay, Lovecraft, well, you've written yourself out of that.
I think that's like, effective. Like, you know, people
always, but it's a little bit of a
like
cheat.
People talk about how, you know, the glowing briefcase from Pulp Fiction, which actually I think is a imagine Tarantino borrowed from somebody else. If you look at there's a Patricia Rosema movie from the 80s called I've Heard the Mermaid Singing, and there is an artist who everybody says is like so great, and then when you see the paintings, it's just light in the frames because anytime you have a movie where like somebody's supposed to be a great painter, a great photographer, unless you show great paintings or great photographs, people in the audience are like,
right,
you're not so great. But you know, by just putting
every
light,
teenager in the world's like,
exactly. But by putting light in the frame, it's like, oh, we don't. It's just we just assume that it's going to be awesome, and we'll project whatever. And so, how did we get here?
By not seeing.
Does it work to not see the monster?
Yeah, no. I liked the ambiguity of not having to know, but just seeing when you see the look, the face of Sarah Paulson, you know, when she looks at it, or the face of other people when they look at it.
Right, the despair you see in her face.
Yeah, some, like those actors are acting the shit out of it, and that tells you everything that you need to know. I actually found it pretty compelling and you know, very and suspenseful at times. I liked John Malkovich's performance.
Oh, he's terrible in this.
Oh, God.
It's so hammy. Even for John Malkovich, it's really super hammy.
First of all, Malkovich is often hammy, and he's doing this for laughs.
He's making a terrific prick here.
But here's the thing. I will almost always watch Malkovich do something that he thinks is going to be fun to do. And he's clearly having a good time. And you know what? That's okay.
I'd rather see him in this than another Transformers movie.
Right. I like Trevante Rhodes in this. I thought he was super charming. I thought that there was an interesting chemistry with him and Sandra Bullock. Like, you know, again, you're right. It is a little too long. And then the stuff that's happening kind of in the present on the river trip, like the sound design of that kind of bugged me a little bit. Because it's like, okay, now it's a little bit like... Not quite as bad, but the way that really obnoxious sound design happens in Where Is Kira, where it's like, we're now going to play all this really jarring music to really mess with you. Like,
to make you on edge
Because I don't think they needed that.
And the flashback structure can so often be annoying, but I like in this one when the movie decides to tell you certain things.
Right.
And when you sort of pick up on what's going on. I thought that was handled, that was crafted really well. I don't know if that's from the book or that's the movie doing it, but I thought all that played out really well. And if I can mansplain motherhood to you.
Please do.
I thought the whole idea of the way that Sandra Bullock was raising these kids amidst this crisis was kind of fascinating, you know, this notion of, like, is she raising them to survive or is she raising them to live, as Trevante Rhodes points out. And it's like, I can't imagine being a parent right now between the internet and school shootings and all this other stuff. Like, how do you give kids a sort of, like, a loving atmosphere and at the same time gird them against the shit show that is the world right now.
I
thought the movie was an interesting metaphor about that.
And here comes my drinking word. I think that kind of the way she keeps a distance with those kids based on what we see early on where she's like so seemingly uninterested in her pregnancy and being a mother, I think that's earned.
It is earned. It has gravitas.
I wouldn't say that's gravitas. I just think it's earned.
Yeah. She alludes to the fact that she herself was like raised by wolves essentially.
Right. Yeah.
And so she doesn't really have any great parenting example for herself. And so that contributes a lot to her own ambivalence about becoming a mom, whatever. I mean, what the whole thing ends up being an allegory for is kind of simple along those lines.
Okay.
The epiphany she achieves at the end is kind of simple. I don't want to give it away, but what this whole sci-fi allegory is for.
Right. After
is
her
like,
painting
oh,
at the beginning, tied to the painting where everybody's all like together, but apart because they're all looking at their devices,
but also like her connection with the kids.
Yeah.
Okay. So I found that to be like, oh, that's it. We're leading up to that. Like that was so basic and so simple. We should mention Eric Heiserer wrote the script, who wrote Arrival as well.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So this, I guess, fits into his wheelhouse in terms of big idea, sci-fi allegory.
No, I like some of the stuff it does, especially like I was particularly, I wouldn't say happy, but I kind of enjoyed that, you know, at one point the one group goes out to the store for a supply run and one of them, the Malkovich character is like, why go back?
Like, let's live in the grocery store.
Like, we're in great shape here. Why are we going back? Right. And I like that because that I felt like that was kind of a grounded conversation that would come up, especially like with this disparate group that was really thrown together.
Yeah.
But the scene in the grocery store makes sense. But like every movie like this has a scene in the grocery store, like name a zombie movie, like The Fog, like that all. Or
that's not a zombie movie.
Though The Mist.
The Mist.
The Mist all takes place in a grocery store. There's so many of them like have that grocery store run moment. I don't know. I feel like I've seen that elsewhere.
Clerks.
I don't know. So I don't know. I don't get the hype of this at all. I don't get why this is a phenomenon.
Look,
I
would much rather this be a hit than Bright or some shit like that.
This is a million times better than Bright.
I mean, and my friend Gary was saying Netflix was brilliant because they realized that week between Christmas and New Year's, people don't want to leave the house. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of big movies open on Christmas and stuff, but really people would just rather stay home. And so this was a good time to sort of build this phenomenon to happen because everybody was like, I'm not going anywhere. Sure, let's watch this thing.
Let's do laundry blindfolded and see how it goes. All right. So my number is a 3. Maybe because of the hype. So I affected your expectations, Matt, because I said it was stupid. Right. My expectations were high because this thing had been like a phenomenon. Mm. So I'm like, ugh, I don't get it.
I'm actually going to go a little higher.
Ooh, what's your number?
I'm going to say a 6.5.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm going to say 7.5.
What does that mean?
So it's a 5.7 total.
5.7.
That's a 7.5.
Yeah. 7.5. I like
so
this.
3 for me, 6.5 for Alonzo, 7.5 for Matt. How often are we this divided on
this
something?
This is pretty divided.
Okay, 5.7. It's a 63% on the tomato meter.
But part of it also, I think, for me is that the ROI on this is relatively easy to achieve. You don't have to go out. Like, you can stay home and watch it.
Right.
Like, that's easier than, getting up and going out to the theater. Like, that's the difference with, say, A Dog's Way Home is, if you could watch A Dog's Way Home at home, you might have a better score.
Have you guys watched Bandersnatch yet?
I have not.
No.
Oh, we have to talk about that.
I don't have time. How do you find time to watch all these things?
I have a TV podcast.
Maybe we'll do it next week.
All right.
Maybe.
Now we've got some movie news for you, Christy, Alonzo, and Matt. And the Golden Globes were this past weekend. So many of you guys wrote on Twitter or wherever and said, please talk about the Golden Globes. So by request, let's do that. So apparently the two best movies of the year are Green Book and Bohemian Rhapsody. So we're all screwed.
Good Lord.
Now, here's the thing that I think is amazing. How is Bohemian Rhapsody not in the musical?
It's all stupid.
How is Green Book a comedy? The categories are the least of our problems here. But
right, if you notice, you've heard us rant about the HFPA.
It is worth noting also that the Hollywood Foreign Press did not let Roma compete in the main categories because the foreign language films only compete in the foreign language category.
Best Director.
Alfonso Cuarón got Best Director, but... Yeah. And of course, nobody directed Bohemian Rhapsody, according to the speeches and the backstage interviews at the with the producers.
It's also
and
icky.
With Rami Malek.
It's also
anyway,
icky.
Yeah.
Both of those winners have icky stuff going on with them.
Yes, I know. And then, since then, as if there weren't enough reasons to hate Green Book, now we find out that Tony Vallelonga tweeted about
Nick, his son.
Oh, sorry, Nick.
Nick Vallelonga.
Nick Vallelonga tweeted that Trump was right and that Muslims were celebrating in the streets of New Jersey when the towers fell, which is a total lie.
Right. So he
kind of a bummer when you have a Muslim
biggest Muslim
role.
Movie star in your movie. Yes,
right. Who also won on Golden Globe night for supporting actor. Right. So Nick Vallelonga wrote the script with Peter Farrelly, who has his own share of weirdness going on here.
Yes, he apologized for all the penis flashing,
which we'll also get.
Memo to everybody. Keep it in your pants.
It was the '90s, Matt. It was the '90s. It was okay to whip your dick out back then. It was all right,
unless you are a member. Unless you have socks and are a member of Red Hot Chili Peppers, or you are Iggy Pop, keep it in your pants.
Only then is okay, right? So Nick Vallelonga.
We didn't know broads were people back then.
Yeah, Nick Vallelonga had a Twitter feed, which he no longer has. He had tweeted at Trump about the alleged Muslim celebrating in the streets, and his whole Twitter feed, I guess, was like MAGA stuff, and he followed Ann Coulter and all the Trump cabinet members and whatever. He has since deleted his whole Twitter account. Then there's this whole thing with Peter Farrelly, stories that were reported many years ago, which are now resurfacing about how he had this running shtick with his brother Bobby. And of course, before he was a serious director, they did raunchy movies.
Yes.
They did Dumber and Dumber. And
I say, what? The guys who made their Something About Mary flashed their penises at people?
But apparently, the bit was to get people to come and look at what was supposed to be a belt buckle, what was actually like his dick hanging out. And they did it to a lot of people, including Cameron Diaz, before she even signed the contract to be in the movie that made her a superstar. So, and she joked about it back then, oh, it's okay. But, I think if she would respond now, she'd feel differently about that. So that's uncomfortable. He has apologized profusely and said, I cringe when I think about the person I was back then. He was in his 40s back then.
The thing that gets me about both of these things, outside of the things happening unto themselves, is, like, have we not learned by now that, like, being an Oscar contender is like running for president? That all this stuff comes up and everything gets looked at and there's always going to be somebody out there, you know, a rival studio is going to, like, try and find whatever they can. Like, where is
right.
the...
So...
What do they call it when a candidate hires somebody to basically find all the dirt on me?
It's not recon research.
No, well, it's but it's the vetting process.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Like, dudes, come on.
Well,
vet yourself.
So, look, this is the old man on this side of the table, having worked on the web for 20-something years, and I've been saying this for years. Like, you don't want people to see some stupid shit that you've done. It used to be, when I was a kid, it used to be just like, make sure no one's watching or make sure nobody's got a camera,
right?
But make sure nobody's watching, because the pool of people that's going to find out about dumb shit that you've done is going to be relatively small as long as you're careful. But now everyone's walking around with a video camera,
mm-hmm.
with access to the internet. There are cameras everywhere. Everybody can report everything. Every citizen in the world is potentially a journalist. So if you don't want someone knowing about stupid shit you've done, don't do the stupid shit. That's really what it boils down to. It's no longer be careful about doing stupid shit. It's, you know what? Let's just stop doing stupid shit entirely.
Well, that was like when you know, we'll get to more on Kevin Hart in a second, but when he was on Ellen, he talked about how people had combed through his tweets to find this stuff. It was like, no, actually, you just put, you know,
right.
whatever his name was, and like fag in the search engine,
right.
and bam, there it is.
Right. You want to know why people aren't going to find anti-Muslim tweets on my timeline? Because I didn't make them.
Right.
You want to
yeah.
know why no one's going to report me about me whipping my junk out? Because I never did it. So
here's a question. Between all of the stuff with...
So nominate me for an Oscar.
Yes.
Or I'll host the show.
Yes.
We'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah. So should this stuff matter? Should things like tweets from years ago, or, you know, behavior that someone has apologized for from decades ago, should that matter when people are assessing the art and not, they're not running for office? I'm putting this out there hypothetically.
Yes.
Should this matter? Should,
yes.
Does this take away from whatever that screenplay was?
I think the question assumes that all awards voting is purely about aesthetic.
Right.
And I don't think it is. I mean, maybe I think critics groups are better about that. But when you talk about the Globes and especially the Academy Awards and the Guild Awards, it's about relationships,
right.
and it's about
rewards.
Well, rewards, and are we friends, and did you help me out,
so,
and, you know, fuck that guy, you know, like, what's the, you know, I think there's always other stuff at play.
Well, if we're separating that out, then okay, then I would say, like, should the personal behavior affect awards consideration and those kinds of decisions versus should personal behavior affect interpretation and reception of art? On the former, I would say it actually matters more because of the statement you're making, right? Like giving somebody, like at this point, like if you know, let's say the Academy next year decides, oh, we're going to give Louis C.K. a Lifetime Achievement Award, right? To use an extreme example. Or let's say, you know, like Grammys are like, hey, we're going to give the Humanitarian Award to R. Kelly, right? Like that's... Forget it, right?
And, that's a, and the that's, statement, a statement
right,
is being made.
A statement's being made.
Right. About the individual.
About the individual,
right.
Especially considering how all those awards have such a political element to them. But I think also it is appropriate to consider the personal life when we look at someone's art, right? Like you can't separate out a classic example. Like I think you really do yourself a disservice if you are interpreting Van Gogh's art, separating out who he was and everything we know about him as a man, right? And so by the same token, we should be revisiting things like Annie Hall or Manhattan, knowing what we now know about Woody Allen. We should be looking back at Polanski's movies, knowing what we know now about him.
Like, but he won Oscars for The Pianist.
I understand.
Did he not?
He did.
Right. And
when
and
he was in exile.
No,
well,
I understand
because
that.
His buddy Jack Nicholson really like lobbied for him.
Well,
is that what it is?
Yeah. Right. And
that helped.
You know, and even at that point, that's what, like 15 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Like even at that point, we're still, I mean, you think like, oh, 15 years ago, didn't we know better? No, we didn't. We didn't, right?
So does this ultimately then, like, is Green Book done for? Is this like a 1-2 punch that's just leveled it, do you think?
I never gave a fuck about Green Book. I hated that movie from the jump, so I don't I would like it to be over for aesthetic grounds, but obviously the Hollywood Foreign Press disagrees. I mean, you know, look, this is all coming out. The Academy votes are due in, for nominations are due in the 14th.
So that's Monday.
Yeah. So the timing is not great. And yep. I think if people were on the fence about it for one reason or another, this might be the kind of thing that pushes them over. But I would say don't nominate Green Book for stuff because it's a shit movie, not because this guy is a creep.
It is amazing that, yeah, that it's gotten so many awards and so much love. And then there's also the underlying substance question with Green Book, you know, that Dr. Don Shirley's family has since come out and said, this is bullshit, although they phrased it as, it's a symphony of lies, which is a far more eloquent way of saying it, that apparently Shirley and Tony Lip weren't really all that close, as the film suggests. So is that a problem? Is it like, you know, every year there's some movie where the true story is and all that true. Yeah, does that matter?
I think Bohemian Rhapsody is totally made up.
I think it does matter. I think it does matter because when you're, look, movies tell us who we are, right? I mean, movies are our modern mythology. Like, they're shared stories, and it helps give us these shared, calm, almost parables to in a lot of cases, live by, right? And I'm probably assigning way too much weight to a movie like Green Book, but that affects how people think. And so that stuff, it does matter, especially like if you were using, oh, this is based on a true story, like then yes, we should know about the truth of something. And, you know, going back to my earlier point, like, I see all the time, and we hear all the time, people get mad, like, oh, it's just a movie. Like, I don't care what the person is. Can't you just enjoy the art? Look, if somebody's personal behavior and the truth behind something gets you to rethink about something you've enjoyed and possibly recontextualize it, and you can't enjoy it blissfully anymore, sorry. Like, that's life. That's reality. I mean, look, one of my favorite movies, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely favorite movie is Fifth Element. And I have a real hard time going back in that, like, kind of knowing what Besson's been up to apparently all along. And it does make me think differently about the story that movie tells and the way he treats that character. Mm-hmm. And okay, fine. I'm not happy about it, but I'm not guaranteed to be happy.
Well,
philosophy for the day.
I don't think that getting biopics wrong necessarily is an issue for awards voters. I mean, the guy who wrote Bohemian Rhapsody, lest we forget, also wrote The Darkest Hour or whatever, the Churchill movie last year that Gary Oldman won an Oscar for, which is also, like, got a lot of stuff in it that is not necessarily historically
kosher. That's true all the time.
You know,
Churchill was never in charge of that country.
Yeah, they tweak things for dramatic effect, or they condense characters down into one, or you know.
And I'm less concerned with that than I am just like, are you telling a good story, and does it pass the smell test? You know, I mean, like Bohemian Rhapsody, for all of its inventions, just isn't that interesting when they aren't singing. Mm-hmm. You know, and I just find a lot of that stuff really contrived. As several people pointed out, it's basically like if Walk Hard never happened. You know, it is.
We've learned nothing.
It is so, you know, chained to the cliches of the rock star biopic. So yeah, you know, I think these are crappy movies, and the detail of verisimilitude or, you know, the personal politics of its creators is a whole other issue, but at the four, they're just not that good. And in a movie in a year that I think is giving us so many great movies, it, you know, somebody on Twitter said, "Why is it that it feels like the Guild people watch about a dozen movies a year?"
And because
that's all they watch. And so there's so many movies that we keep talking about to we're blue in the face, like Leave No Trace, like the Sisters Brothers, that people just will not throw their screener into the into the DVD player. But you know, they keep coming out for crap like Green Book and Bohemian Rhapsody.
Well, so let's also be real clear here. Do we? I mean, you would be naive. I think we'd all be naive to think that people who vote have seen everything they're even voting for.
Sure. No,
people vote for things they haven't even seen or didn't even bother to vote. I know someone who's had a parent in the Grammys and would let their child vote
Amazing.
For them.
I've helped
right,
somebody vote for the Grammys before, and I don't even know anything about music.
Tell me about it.
I know. It's crazy. That's kind of why I tend to respect critics groups' votes more, just because I feel like those are people who have been watching movies all year long, and that's their
or
job.
We're thorough.
And then once we do get to the Academy Awards, now nobody's going to be hosting it, because Kevin Hart is definitely not, despite we talked last week about Ellen's efforts to persuade the Academy to bring Kevin Hart back as Oscar host. He's made it unequivocally clear on Good Morning America, where he was supposed to have been talking about The Upside. Mm-hmm. He's like, I'm done talking about it. And once again, he's so defiant and so bitter. Like, the tone is tonally so off. Like, he's handled it so wrong the whole way through. And he's just like, I'm done talking about it. And if people can't see that I have love in my heart, then it's their problem.
Who should host it?
He is who?
John Lasseter.
We're going to talk about him in a second, too. He's next.
Yeah, Kevin Hart has managed to make himself the victim in all this, mm-hmm. which is rich.
Can we have Sabrina host it?
That'd be awesome.
Her social media is totally clean.
This whole thing of, like, I mean, I love... Did y'all see Don Lemon's CNN editorial?
Yeah,
that
was good.
Go back and watch that if you haven't seen it, because that's like... You never apologized. The closest thing you did was you said, well, I can't tell those jokes anymore because everyone's so sensitive now. That's not an apology.
It's our problem.
I hate when comics say that. Comics say that, it's like, guys, it's because that's all you got.
Yeah, Chris Rock at the New York Film Critics Circle this week was trotted out some version of that, and somebody on Twitter was like, or I think it was Drew McQueenie, said, actually, I've seen a lot of really great comedy lately and from some really interesting sources and from new points of view, and maybe the problem is Chris Rock. Maybe it's not that audiences are so PC. You know?
Right. Maybe your art form, stand-up comedy, has to evolve as the audience evolves. Maybe. Call me crazy.
Crazy thoughts.
Maybe.
So now there's not going to be any host at all, which, if I recall correctly, we here at this very table suggested might be a good idea. That's how we do things at our LA Film Critics Dinner. That's how we're going to do things Saturday night at our LA Film Critics Dinner.
Who will do the insane goofball musical number monologue at the beginning?
Maybe there's not one.
Well, you know, there have been years in the past where people come out and do that number, and then that's all they do. Like, there's one that look for this on YouTube. I'm not making it up. It's like, I want to say it's Telly Savalas, Dom DeLuise, and Pat Morita.
Oh, my God.
Seriously.
That's better than Rob Lowe and Snow White.
There's one where, like, Terry Garr came out and did a whole, like, flying down to Rio number or something. God. And then that's it. You don't see them again for
the show.
What's
funny is a lot of times the hosts come on and they do, like, the first 20 minutes of the show, right? And then, like, halfway through the show, you don't see them anymore.
Right.
Like, they're gone. Mm-hmm. Right? So...
It'll be fine. Maybe it'll move faster. Maybe it'll be shorter because there's no host. Or there's going to have a series of, like, A-list people introducing each segment, whatever. February 24th, that's coming out. Let's talk really fast about John Lasseter, because this is news that just came out yesterday afternoon. John Lasseter, who wasn't necessarily fired from Pixar, just his contract wasn't renewed after multiple complaints of being touchy and enforcing a harassing kind of boys club environment at Pixar, now has a new gig at Skydance as the head of their new animation branch. Skydance is a production company. So he's like a year later, he's landed on his feet.
So everyone who predicted that powerful white men who got Me Too'd were going to continue to be powerful white men after a suitable period of absence, you were right.
Yeah, Variety has a story, some exclusive story about the details of his contract where they're saying that if indeed there are any more complaints about this kind of a behavior while he's there, that he has to pay personally for.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's all kinds of like caveats to keep him on the straight and narrow, as it were.
I would say go to Variety and find the editorial that was written by a woman who worked at Pixar and was forced out by the toxic atmosphere there, because I think there is a version of the events out there where people are like, oh, John Lasseter is just socially awkward and he would just sort of like hug people and he didn't know what he was doing. And, you know, apparently tons of sexism at Pixar, and like there was actually that women who worked there had a maneuver called the Lasseter to avoid said hugging. And, you know, the whole thing with firing Brenda Chapman from Brave, like generally speaking, like women don't get promotions. Women get screwed over there. So it's a bigger problem.
Right. Don't tell me that guy's a storyteller the way he is and has turned that whole animation group at Disney around the way he has. And
doesn't understand how women work,
how personal relationships work.
Right.
Right.
Cassandra Smolchik is the woman who wrote the piece in Variety. She worked for Pixar for like 5 years.
Well, look, I'll tell you part of why Skydance cuts that deal is because they can get in cheap, right? I mean, that's what happens. There's, you know, a company that I know of that after that had hired someone to produce something that had been let go from a network. I mean, like, you hear this all the time, right? Like, somebody who was really on top of the world, mm-hmm. you know, loses their job because of harassment or whatever other misbehavior. Not that I'm trying to belittle it, but like something like harassment, and somebody else tries to give them a job partly because that company knows that they can get them cheap.
There's a fire
right?
sale.
Right. And so that's the thing that absolutely happened with Skydance.
And this is Megan Ellison's brother's company, right?
Is it?
Megan Ellison's brother?
Yes. So, so the Variety story says that John Lasseter's contract with Skydance Media contains provisions that make the former Pixar animation chief financially responsible for any legal claims involving sexual harassment. So
yeah, they knew what they were getting into. Like there's a whole memo that David Ellison sent out to the company basically saying like, we understand there might be some concern, but we think he didn't really do anything and we're going to sit down and
we don't take this lightly.
It all smacks
the savings we get for getting John Lasseter, the guy that turned Disney animation around,
exactly.
It makes it worth
the
it
creator
for us.
Pixar. Right. Yeah. It's, you know, I hope that this is not the, you know,
Well, and I hate to say this. Look at Skydance's slate of movies.
Like the Top Gun sequel.
Like it's all like, you know, bro-heavy action stuff.
Right. Well, they did that. They tried to reboot the Terminator franchise.
Right.
Remember that one? Like, they do like all the Tom Cruise movies.
Mission
right?
Impossible Fallout was really good, you guys.
No, I agreed. Agreed.
But yeah, no, I, the bigger picture here is, and we were warned about this from the get-go, that like we're going to see people like Weinstein or, you know, Kevin Spacey or whatever go away for a while, claim to be learning something, and then like expect to just breeze back in like nothing happened.
Oh, the nerve of Spacey.
Well, Louis C.K. is trying to do that right now.
Yes.
He's trying to like re-embark on his comedy tour.
Right.
But
he's
now,
like, what are they going to do? Take away my birthday? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. We're going to take away your birthday, Louis C.K.
Yeah, but it's going to be interesting to see if there are enough people with enough clout to be like, nope. Sorry. And it's funny because, you know, Dave and I were talking about this. He goes, well, what does somebody have to do to, you know, get their position back to re-enter? And I said, we haven't even seen anybody try. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen anybody make the remotest sort of good faith effort to, like, step away, listen to the people that they've wronged, learn something, use their clout to make things better in the industry. No one's done that.
Well, here's the...
They go away for a while, they have radio silence, and they come back like nothing happened, and then they're the aggrieved
party. But here's the thing. Like, if you get to a level... If you get to a certain level in whatever your industry and you have this great career on the backs of, you know, among other things, people that you've abused and used, right? Like if there's been some level of malfeasance that has helped you get there,
sure,
right? Then maybe you got to start from square one all over again. And if that means a different industry, none of those relationships that you established when you were at the top, maybe those don't count anymore. Maybe it's go back to jail, don't collect $200, don't pass go. Like, you got to start back from square one, tough shit.
Yeah,
In the mailroom.
I don't know what the answer is.
Change your name, change your face, get a new identity, start from scratch.
I don't know what the answer is, and it's not up to me to say what the answer is. I think it's up to the people involved.
Oh, it's up to me. I'm in charge.
But, you know, like let the Time's Up and Me Too people maybe sort of establish what that kind of, you know, forgiveness looks like. But again, no one's even trying.
Right.
We will follow all of this. Thank you so much for sticking around and listening. Next week, Glass is the biggie, I want to say.
Yes.
We're seeing Glass on Monday night.
Yes.
Early word is not good on Glass. I like Split.
I have to go back and watch Unbreakable and Split to see Glass.
I just watched Unbreakable again. It holds up pretty well.
Okay.
That's what I hear.
This is part of this M. Night Shyamalan trilogy. So that's our biggie for next week, and so we will talk about that
right.
and so much more.
Thanks, everybody, for following us over. If you, you know, have friends who are wondering, hey, where's What the Flick? Tell them it's Breakfast All Day. So we're BFast All Day on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Podbean and Stitcher and Google Play and all those kind of of places, and you can subscribe to our videos again at YouTube. You know, leave us ratings, leave us that 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. That helps a lot for people to find the show. Tweet us, you know, twat us, tweet us. I never know how
twat
to say
it. Me.
Guys,
keep those tweezies coming. Anyway, thanks for being here.
Thanks,
this
guys.
Is why I get to host the Oscars, not them.
Bye.